Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. The holidays are sort of approaching, aren't they? You can feel it. Everyone's busy and restaurants are unusually noisy now with office parties and long tables. And we get to the end of the year in good shape. Well, that's probably relative, but we have a working, if fractious, coalition government going about its business. The stock market is generally up. The rand is holding its ground. There are huge issues to resolve, but this is South Africa, and when weren't the issues gigantic? Interest rates have fallen appreciably in the last 3 months, and unemployment seems to have fallen sharply after the May 29 election, though while politicians might want to claim immediate credit for that, I think we should wait for a few quarters more and see what the trend is like. I've never met my guest today, at least I don't think I have, and that's probably because his career has been an almost fairy tale story of humble beginnings and then one huge and always successful adventure after the next, while mine has been pretty pedestrian. We were, however, lucky enough to be born and raised in the same town, Mthatha, about 10 years apart, and there the similarities end. Mteto Nyati is now the chairman of Eskom, and while he may be slightly reluctant to discuss his role in the saving of Eskom and its fact is that his turnaround path bears a striking parallel to his arrival on the board in September 22 and subsequent elevation to the chair a year later. Initially, I'd hoped we would focus the podcast on South Africa's energy future, but then over the weekend, I read his biography, Betting on a Darkie, which he published in 2019. I'm so glad I did. It not only reminded me where we come from, but you know, also who we are. And the book's still around, and I urge you, if you've got time, buy it for Christmas to read it. Teto Nyati, thank you very much for joining me here. The thought of growing up and going to school in Mthatha made me wonder what different lives we would have led in that so familiar setting all those years ago. I was aware of apartheid, and I knew the sort of Nats were bad. My parents had black guests. It was scandalous in Mthatha at the time at their parties, but I grew up worrying really about atomic bombs and learning how to hide under my desk in case one fell on Mthatha. And my heroes when I was young were the guys who won World War II and thought of driving a Japanese car, I remember, would never have occurred to my father who served in the Pacific during the war. I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about what it was like being a black child in the same town that I was growing up in. You went to St. John's College, a very fine school that I know. And a few years after I went to Mthatha High School. But what was it like growing up then? What did you worry about? And would our lives have been so different then that we would still be strangers to each other now?
Bruce, thank you so much Peter. Thank you so much for having me on your show. What would it have been like growing up in Mthatha during those years? It was, first of all, there's nothing that to us, our environment was what it is. So we knew nothing different. So we took it as what it was, environment where we were generally seeing people like myself struggling where they were, shops and things like that. You may be aware of Vigisville, and places like that, where there were these big shops. They used to be owned by white folks, and our interaction with them was largely, us being the customers at their big shops. But the relationship was always a good one. Many of them could speak the same language as us, Tosa, and we used to be able to go play with their kids. So there was this thing that we were experiencing in South Africa, the apartheid. It was not something that we were really experiencing through our interactions with the folks that were living with us. There was generally a respect, and many of them used to help and support some families, you maybe pick up a child that has got potential. They would support that child in terms of education. So that's really the relationship that we had with white folks at the time. In my own space, my dad was not so much into farming, whereas everybody else around us, they had this herd of cattle and sheep. My dad was not that kind of a person. He had only one cow, and we used to, I think, on a every fortnight, take it to a dipping tank.
Yep.
Many kilometers away from where we were staying.
But somebody would make a note of the dip, yeah?
Yeah. So and it was tough because none of us were having any shoes. So we didn't own any pair of shoes. So we typically during the winter season, it was really, really tough taking these cows there.
But at least your dad never slaughtered the cow.
All we're getting, it was like milk. And that's it. It was quite a productive.
But that's the way. And this is Buti. This is Buti, your dad. Your aunts called him Buti. Yeah, I can just imagine that.
He used to call it, because we grew up with our aunts. They used to call. Of course, he was their brother. They were calling him Buti. So all of us ended up calling him.
It's a very affectionate thing, I think, to call somebody Buti. But I mean, the other, obviously, there was the Vigie family at Vigiesville, but there was also a big trading family called the Spargs, who you'll remember. Yeah,
that's where I grew up, going to Spargs to go get, because my mother ended up, she cashed her pension money and set up this trading store in Dabase. And we used to go to Sparks Wholesalers to go get all of the groceries for the shop, of the stock. We got it from there. So that's the place that you would find me there and my brothers and my sisters and my mom. Yeah. And my mom used to drive this big truck, almost every other day to go get stock from Sparks Wholesalers.
You know, you'll agree with me, I'm sure, that some of those Transkei traders, those white businesses, are really the richest people still in this country. They had enormous amounts of money. And there was the other family, which is slightly out of Mthatha reach, was the Goss family, where you now have somebody like Pat Goss, who is one of the co-founders of RMB. His family were big traders in kind of Pondoland, sort of, slightly away from Mthatha. And Pat left RMB early on. He remained a shareholder, but he started Boxer. It was just in his blood, trading was something just in his blood, and he eventually sold it to Pick and Pay. And he's still very much active in business. And like the Sparks, Pat speaks absolutely fluent and flawless isiXhosa. It's quite remarkable. I ask because while I'm a little older than you are, I suspect our children are around the same age, and I'm quite terrified for my kids. I didn't prepare them for a world full of hatred and conflict. And when they were born in 1993, the Cold War had ended. Globalization was the economic sort of order of the day. Liberal democracy was ascendant and, everywhere. And perhaps most fabulously expressed in the liberation of this country, South Africa, in 1994. 20 years on, things don't look so good.
Yeah, we are 30 years on now. And when you look back, yes, there are some areas where things have moved forward. Things like, for example, someone coming from the energy sector, the fact that most of the houses are electrified, you know, and that's a plus. They've built a number of schools. That is also a plus, you know. However, in the province that I come from, we still have many schools that are still not having proper kind of toilets, you know, and that's a concern. You know, after 30 years, we still have that situation. I go to my town, Amthatha, which is a beautiful town, small town. It is a shadow of itself now, you know, and the kind of criminality and crime that is in that space, it's really, you just do not want to go back there.
We
used to be so proud of that town and just being there, and the roads full of potholes in town.
The roads are special, eh? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit sad, you know. So in many ways, we'll find that many people have moved to middle class, people have access to education, but their condition has not changed that much, you know, and that's a sad thing. You know, compared to the Americans, there's this whole notion in those environments, even in Europe, where the next generation has to be better, much, much better than the generation before. They call that perpetual progress. And this is something that I'm struggling, because when I look at some of our kids, they are not doing much better than we were. You know, many of them are trapped in this high unemployment situation, although they've got the education. And that is not a good thing.
Well, it's not only not a good thing, it's quite a scary thing, because the world is becoming more dangerous. It's not just South Africa, you know. If you were living now in France, as you did for many years, or sort of slightly east of France, Italy, you know, you're close to new wars in the Ukraine and a very belligerent Russia and now a belligerent America in different ways. America doesn't want to start wars, but it's going to start trade wars. It's hard to sort of prepare your children. Well, if it's impossible, because you simply don't know. But you make the point in your lovely, lovely book, and congratulations. And I should have read it years ago, but I really made my weekend. You make the point that education and enterprise are the things that we need in this country. And tell me why you think they're not happening. Where's the, if it's so obvious, and we've had a party in power that has been completely in power for 30 years up until recently. If all of these things are so obvious, why have they not happened?
Yeah, I think generally my own analysis of what is going on in our country is that it boils down to leadership or lack of leadership. You know, I look at the number of schools that I know that they are in rural areas and they've got no internet. Some of them have got no electricity. You know,
Some of them have got no windows.
Yes, but they've consistently been producing exceptional results, you know? And then you say, to ask yourself, is it about the resources or is it about, yes, we would love all of schools to have the best kind of infrastructure and resources, but the reality is that they don't. And here you have these schools that are doing exceptionally well with limited resources, and you look deep and you realize that it's about that headmaster, it's that principal, and it's the kind of discipline that this person has instilled in that school, you know, and how the teachers within that school, they do what they've been hired to do, which is to teach kids, and they care about that. But it starts from the leader, right? And so it's no coincidence that they're producing these results. And there's a link, direct link, with the kind of culture that you have within that school. and a culture that comes directly, largely from the leadership of the school. So then you go to hospitals. Again, generally, most of the hospitals are failing, but you find those that are not, right? The same thing with municipalities. Many of them are failing, but then you find those that don't. What is the constant? What is the thing that separates the ones that it's always leadership, you know? So for me, our problem is a leadership problem we had in South Africa.
You know, you're so right. I used to drive. So my drive from through the Transkei normally takes me on the way home. I take the road from Mthatha through Ngobo and on to Komati, Queenstown. And Ngobo used to be the dirtiest place in the country without any question. There was just litter everywhere. And one year, it was clean, like ridiculously clean. And then it lapsed back into paper everywhere. But I'd noticed that Idutswa was suddenly clean. And apparently the mayor of Ngobo had been moved to Idutswa and he's just doing the same job again. It was extraordinary. And I'm making they're far away from me, but I've got to find this man, and we need to make him a hero. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. And the businesses in Dutchwa, the Spargs and all of those people, they love this guy because he's making the town bearable again. You know, you switch on a tap and water comes out, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. I think
that our notion of leadership is a different one where I'm now generalizing, but you find that people think that by relaxing things, by not creating structures, that's what needs to happen. You know, there needs to be, but that leads to chaos. And I've never seen any country that has, they can point to chaos and say, hey, we are this developed country at the back of chaos. No. It's always at the back of there's a discipline, there's focus, there's structures, people are being held accountable, you know. And even I look at the way we think about crime, we are always explaining why, you know, of course people are hungry. Right.
So we're excusing it.
People don't have jobs, but you just look across up north, look at in Zimbabwe, look at the many countries that are in a difficult, much, much worse situation than us, but they've got absolutely no crime. So it's got nothing to do with the material condition of the people.
Yeah.
You know, it's really about how the leaders of the country. Yeah. Instilling, you know, the respect of law. Yeah. The respect of law and order. We used to call it law and order. Now we call it something else, you know. And I'm insisting on using that law and order thing because I think we need to have order, you know.
Yeah.
Just looking at how people are respecting traffic's rules and looking at a crossing of the road. You know, the lawlessness is everywhere.
Yeah.
And we need to stop that.
We need to stop it without, if possible, without surrendering our democracy, because that's quite a precious thing to have, you know.
We don't have to go to a dictatorship.
We don't have to be Singapore, yeah.
No, we don't have to be that. You can just, I call it tough love, you know. People need to know that this is how you must respect rules. It's just that, respect the rules. It's the same. I mean, we're saying we're in the same country. You go to Cape Town, look at how the taxis are behaving in that environment and versus the taxis in Johannesburg. Yeah. There's a difference.
Yeah.
That is because there are consequences in Cape Town for doing certain things. It may not be a popular thing, but the rules are there for a reason, you know.
Yeah.
So So it's that kind of stuff that we need to do. Let's not go back to dictatorship. We don't want that.
Yeah. Maybe the thing we had in common in Amtata was a sort of slightly Victorian background. You know, your parents and my parents would have grown up with Victorian values and manners. So your parents were saying, your dad, Buti, was saying to you, you've got to become a doctor and study hard. And I said, my parents, my dad, who was a building contractor in town, was saying, you know, you've got to become an architect. I'm a great disappointment to my parents. You must be, you never were. But
they are so disappointed with me. I chose something that they did not want.
Never mind. Yeah. So you wrote in Business Day, a paper with which I was once the editor. In Business Day, you wrote a piece and you said the following. You said, the fight in South Africa is really about who sets the national agenda, the ANC or the white elite. And now, that's 30 years ago, 20 years ago. And obviously, we've been through a lot politically since then. But do you still think that?
Look, let's broadly say that
yeah.
there is a continuously questioning of the black majority by the white minority, you know.
Okay, fair enough. I think it's fair enough.
So there is that thing. And that questioning is most of the time is actually not justified, you know. But it's based on some form of people thinking that they are superior. You know? Let's just look at this example of the whole energy equation, you know. We nearly moved into a situation where we were putting our energy security at risk because we're not questioning things. We're moving full on steam renewables and let us not take care of our existing coal fleet. And let's not have Eskom participating in renewables. All of that thing, it's an interesting thing, and it's largely a white driven thinking. I'm not saying that it should, but it's largely driven by whites, that thinking, But we also have got a big problem of unemployment in our country. We need to be also thinking about all of these towns and places where what is going to happen to the people that used to be dependent on all of this, the mining that was happening. There's no thought that is being given there. Let us move. Let us just move.
Yeah.
If you are bringing the discussion of, hey, let us think also about this element. It's like you are standing in front of progress, you know. But it is something that we need to take care of. Otherwise, we're going to have a problem, you know. But now that you'll have a Trump that is saying certain things about coal, it's going to suddenly become it's acceptable. But why was it not acceptable only two months ago? You know, it is that thing that is bothering. For example, we hired a brilliant CEO in Eskom, as in Dan Marokana. You know, somebody that has got the experience. He had been in that environment. We knew that he's going to hit the ground running. You know, and then the next thing the comment coming from a DA, I'm going to use a DA. Hmm. The comment coming from a DA about his appointment is he does not inspire confidence. Oh, really? I mean, based on what? I mean, what is it that you would have wanted him to be so that you can feel that he's inspiring confidence? What assessment have you made? You know, why are you choosing to have this kind of a position, really? Yeah. Have you checked this person? What are you also saying about the board that applied its mind around this thing? I mean, so it's those things that you are, you have this blep.
Yeah.
Thoughts or decisions are questioned, and when you go deeper into them, you start to realize that this, yeah, it's really, it does not sit well, you know.
Yeah.
And just
come back a little bit on the energy thing, and I understand what you're saying about renewable energy being a kind of white enthusiasm, and everybody got very excited. But at the time, Eskom's coal was failing. And so it wasn't unreasonable necessarily to think, well, if we could have an alternative to Eskom, what's it going to be? And of course, there's lots of sunshine and quite a lot of wind. And so it didn't seem to be. I'm happy to put myself in that category. I mean, I didn't think of it as a white thing. I just thought it as an obvious thing. The fact that Eskom has turned around and has restored the status quo ante. In fact, because it wasn't Eskom itself damaged. Eskom damaged itself, and Eskom has fixed itself.
Well, I get that, Cruz. I get that 100%. Eskom shoots itself in the foot. They damage themselves, but
they fix themselves now, which is great.
Yes, yes, yes. But my point here is that, I hear leaders from business saying, guys, there's going to be this, there's going to be this blackout.
Hmm? Yeah.
You know, the grid is going to collapse. Really? I mean, yeah. It's going to collapse the grid. The very fact that we are doing load shedding, it demonstrates our ability to prevent that kind of thing from ever happening, you know. And then you have these people who, in their normal lives, they would normally, as business, they would gather the facts and make sure that they are making decisions based on proper facts. In this case, they choose not to, I don't know, I'm saying choose, but they do not apply the same thing. They just take whatever they are hearing. And then they go and I just, sometimes don't understand.
So I understand that. But there was a period when it wasn't unreasonable to be disappointed by Eskom's performance, because Eskom had broken itself. And thank goodness it's now fixed itself, which couldn't have been an easy task. But while it was broken, life was pretty miserable. And it obviously fed this notion. Which have been pre-existing in the white community, that a black government couldn't look after the country. And so I know, I hear exactly what you're saying, but I wonder whether it doesn't over time sort of dissipate. It doesn't show up in election numbers, because the DA, such as it represents white votes, gets absolutely nowhere. The ANC, to the extent that it still represents the black voices, is on the slide, and there are other voices taking votes away from them. So I just wonder whether your earlier notion that it was, the ANC versus with the white elite in terms of who sets the national agenda, whether that's still applied or whether it's become a little bit more complicated than that now.
I think it is. It's a layered thing. There are still elements where it is true, and there are elements where this question is no longer really relevant. You cannot describe it in terms of race, you know.
Yeah.
And so we are moving away from that, but certainly, as a black person myself, I can experience, I may be telling the truth, but my truth may not even be nobody would ever believe it. They can believe a lie as long as it is not somebody that is like me, So that is the reality of where we still are at, you know, still have that. And just by me being appointed as the chairman of ESCOM, I'm already labeled as a corrupt person. Just purely, a person has not even done any research on anything. So, and they're already just purely by looking at the color. Then you realize that this is somebody that is a cater deployed person, and when you, in reality you have not been deployed by anybody, you were approached based on your one's own experience, and that is what you are bringing to the job, the experience of fixing things.
So you had high hopes for Cyril Ramaphosa when he first came into power. And I remember in the book you said there are a couple of things that need to be done, and you listed them. But he almost sank you, because you were then, at the time, you were CEO of Altron, and you were trying to clean up Altron, which you eventually did very successfully. But at the time, you were trying to sell a big subsidiary. I think it was called Powertech. And Cyril being Cyril, had allowed a debate to flourish in Parliament. Under which the economic freedom fighters wanted a debate on expropriation without compensation. And the buyers that you'd lined up for Powertech were German, and they basically they wanted to pull out. They didn't want to invest in a country which they thought. How did you save that deal?
That deal was almost like off the table. At the back of the developments that were happening in the country at the time. And I decided that, look, before we say we give up, let me invite the key leaders of that business into South Africa and let me invite them and try and connect them, some key leaders, CEOs in our country who would be able to give them, let me say, a much more balanced perspective on South Africa. So I reached out to people like Bonang Mohale. I reached out to people like Mike at Nedbank. I reached out to Business Leadership South Africa. You know, and these are people that gave me the time, and they were able to give these investors a much more balanced view of South Africa, without trying to paint a picture that was like a great. No, they just gave an honest view of what was going on, and that made them to be much more comfortable. I think also the choice of the leaders that I decided to connect them with, it was a different leaders, from government, from public sector, from this, and not one race, So it was, you could not say that this was an orchestrated thing to just try and create a view of South Africa. No, it was just genuinely South Africans talking about their country. And the risk, yes, there are risks in South Africa, but they were manageable. So that helped a lot. That made them to be much more calm, and we were able to close the deal.
So just keeping back to Cyril, you also write in the book, you say, there is a formula for success, and we better get our heads around the fact that if we constantly harp on about race, we'll never move forward. But the harping, now this is back in 2019, maybe even before 2018 when you wrote this, but the harping continues today. And you've made the point yourself that you're in your own position now, after all of your experience and the contribution that you've made, you still feel that there are people out there judging you because of the color of your skin. How do we get this right? I mean, first of all, the harping is inside Cyril Ramaphosa's government, a lot of it, in his cabinet, some of it. And obviously outside in wider society as well. I mean, is Cyril really the man or the leader you and perhaps I hoped he would be?
Our president, as someone who has been exposed to the business, to the business world, he comes already with a perspective which was really a good one, because this is somebody that's exposed to business, understands what the business needs in order for business to grow and to invest in the country. So that's a positive thing, and he still has that. I do think that the environment that he's operating in is constrained by the fact that in the first 5 years, he really did not have the kind of big support that was required for him to make some of the changes that were required. So that may have constrained him. But we do think that I personally think that he could have done a lot more when it comes to issues of trying to unify the country. You know, he is someone who always goes back and talk about Mandela. You know, and one of the things that Mandela did well was to reach across and focus on South Africa, focus on creating an environment where everybody feels like they belong to South Africa. This vision of South Africa belongs to all. And I think we're losing that. That's the thing that it worries me. And when I look at how the many, many organizations that I've worked for, the ones that have been successful, whether you go to MTN or you go to Altron or to go to where I am now in Eskom. It's us coming together as South Africans addressing a problem. It's not any one group. It is us. And that formula always works. You know, when you bring an environment where people feel like they are part of something, they are not threatened by anything, they give their all to whatever needs to be done, and they know that they are going to be recognized if they are contributing positively. In that environment, you would find that things, the turnarounds, they will call that, hey, Mteto did the turnaround. It's actually the people. They are the ones that they did the turnaround. It's not necessarily the leader. Of course, the leader created the environment. So I think us continuously talking about our people, how many people, when leaders say our people, does everybody think that they are part of this our people, or they think that this our people belongs to a certain group, you know? And that's the problem. We need to be much more specific, need to create an environment where people feel like they are needed, feel like their contribution is needed. And I think we can do, all of us can do a lot more around that.
I mean, it's got to do with achieving things, I think, together. You know, you look at the Springbok rugby team, what a fairy tale yes. that has become. It's almost a cliche, you know? And one of the reasons, I'm just thinking as you're talking, one of the reasons you feel, I suspect, mistrusted by white people or just people generally because you're now at Eskom is because the politicians for so long said, this will be done in a month, this will be done in a month. So when, by the time you were on the board and there was a new board and Pravin Gordhan, bless him, the late Pravin Gordhan, said, was saying once again that this time we're going to get it right. This time we're going to. And of course, by that stage, the country had heard this story for many years.
Many times.
From the same people, you know. And you're probably also a little bit a victim of that. But we'd come back to today, Mteto. You say, once again, quoting from your book, the sooner we stop revering big talkers, okay, and start embracing a culture of education, entrepreneurship, the better. But isn't it shocking that literally nowhere on our spectrum of politics, from right to left, whichever you think is right and left, nowhere is there the slightest interest in enterprise and entrepreneurship, of getting people, giving people the space and the opportunity and the environment to start a small business and help themselves?
It is sad. I mean, we have got so many problems in our country, in South Africa, and across the continent, we've got so many problems. But those are opportunities for people to solve them through enterprise. You know, people come up with solutions to address these things, you know. But we are leading with the notion of wanting, always wanting to do things for people, you know, instead of encouraging them and supporting them to do things for themselves. So as a result, it is, you know, they are not being resourceful. Yet I know that South Africans are so resourceful, you know, but we're always, you know, we're not encouraging them. We're not giving them the incentive, you know, and that is the failure of all of us, you know.
You know, I think that coming from Transkei, both you and me, we probably realize just how resourceful people really are. People who've got nothing and who lives very far away from any kind of infrastructure, that somehow they make a living that might be, you know, with a few cattle here and a few breaks here and there, maybe some money from somebody who has got a job in the mines. But the size of the, we call it the gray economy to avoid calling it the black economy. But there's, you know, there's an untaxed, unseen economy in this South Africa that must be working, because half the population isn't working and they're still alive and surviving. And there's no revolution. Something is working here. We don't capture it.
Yes, yes. I mean, we right now the spaza shops are something that is topical, and to some extent, I grew up in that environment. My mother had a little shop that could have been called a spaza shop during those days, but it grew from that to being a big trading store, you know. And that is what needs to be encouraged. And it has to be South Africans that are doing that. It's not, it should not be, it should not outsource it to foreigners doing that, you know. So it's concerning me. And the reason why a number of people that are coming to our country that's 5 years down the line after coming to South Africa, coming with nothing, they are already employing us, you know, and that's sad, you know, because these people came with nothing, and through legal ways, they are now employing 10, 15 South Africans. We should be doing that to ourselves, you know.
I mean, one of the ideas that I keep meaning to write this and I never get around to it is, and going back to your experience at St. John's in Mthatha, is an idea to create, and if the government, of course, you've got to go back and ask permission for everything you do, is to have a, somehow try and find a way to build boarding schools in rural areas, particularly in the Eastern Cape. And I just imagine 50 St. John's colleges, what that would do to the country, or even in the Eastern Cape, where you could, you know, where teachers live on the premises, where students live on the premises, where people are properly fed, where there's medical care, where there's sports facilities, where the grass is mowed and the lines are painted on every weekend, where there's competition between schools, where there's a bus you can travel from school to school in. That's not hard stuff. We all know how to do that. Is it, you know, boarding schools have been existed in this country for years. Is there not room here, and it doesn't threaten anyone politically at all. It's a good thing. I mean, could the private sector not go and build schools? And would the government say to them, no, you can't, because we control the schools and we don't want any more private schools? And that's because that's what you're facing with in a government with, you know, with the great reformer in charge of it. And he's, you know, sorry to carry on prattling, but
look, it's a great idea. It is a good idea, and I do think that it can work to some extent. But I want to go back to the earlier discussion that we have had. I think our problems are less about that, but more about leadership. So I want to go back to, you know, the schools that are not performing. It's not because they're not boarding schools. It's not because, I think it's because they lack the right kind of leaders to lead those schools. So our problem, we can narrow it down to how many schools do we have in this country? I don't know, maybe 200,000 schools. So our problem is, can we make sure that each and every one of those schools have got the right kind of a leader? That action alone can make a huge difference in terms of education. You know, it's the same thing that you can do with all of the public hospitals. Let us apply our minds. Who are the best leaders that can lead these public hospitals? And put them in those that will make a big difference. You know, so I do think that this is where we need to be going. It's no surprise that we're having this kind of a change in ESCOM. It's because the time was taken to make sure that we have people that have got the skills that talk to the problem, you know?
Yeah, yeah. More specific about today, I mean, how do you feel about the government of national unity? Is Cyril Ramaphosa in control? And I sometimes have to ask whether he even wants to be in control. There's a lot of bickering, which he stays away from. So everybody's saying we're going to leave, and people are saying, well, then go, and what do you think of it generally? Are the DA ministers and other ministers having a positive impact? What does success for the GNU look like? It can't just arrive and form, you know, it's got to do something. What's it got to do to be successful?
I think, Peter, for me, we should not see the GNU as an end in itself. You know, and sometimes I hear people talking about GNU as being, it's like an achievement. We have achieved GNU and we should be happy. You know, it cannot be an end. It's just a means to an end. You know, and we need to, if you ask yourself and ask anybody, what kind of a South Africa are we trying to build? You will probably get different answers from whoever you are asking. So that there lies the problem for me, that if you go to the Asian tigers, all of these countries that they've turned themselves around, they've developed themselves, all of those countries, and those countries had a national agenda. They're very clear about what they are trying to build, and they enroll business. They get the labor unions, everybody being behind that agenda. We are trying to build this kind of a country, and these are the industries that we are going after, and these are the sacrifices that we are going to be making in order to get there, you know. But we are all pulling in the same direction. That is what is missing from a GNU perspective. What we have now is a collection of people that are driving their individual things that do not necessarily talk to where are we going, what are we trying to build as a country, you know. So the individual efforts that are good, all of them, but may not always be, you know, they're not going to be making that a big of a difference.
Does Jacob Zuma worry you?
Not really, no. I think South Africans, we often underestimate South Africans. South Africans, they get it, you know. Yes, of course, there will be those that have gone there, that direction. Many people were worried about going also to the EFF, but generally South Africans are very much in the middle, you know.
And they have
seen what they saw when the president was the president of the country, and They had an option to vote for him. 15%, 14 point something voted for him. I don't think we're going to be getting any better than that.
And does Donald Trump worry you?
No, as not at all as well, because I do think people like him, it's always easier when you can see, when you look at the person and you know where that person stands, and it makes life so much easier. You know, he is very clear about certain things. But of course, if we do not, knowing what we know about him, and we then make things that are going to put our country in a risky situation, then that is worrying. But it's all going to be on us. It's not going to be on him. It's how we show up. It's how we connect with his country. It will determine whether we benefit out of him being there or we get punished.
There's a new IRP, an energy plan, in the process of being formed. What is your ideal future energy mix going on for the next 10 years? Should we be building more coal? Should we be building gas? Should we be building nuclear? Should we carry on building renewables?
It is so important that we align with the rest of the world, Peter, when it comes to renewables. So that's the direction that we need to, as ESCOM, we have embraced that future and we're going there in a big way. If you look at us in 10 years from now, probably 30%+ of our energy will be coming from renewables. Then gas will be around another 10 to 15% will be gas. From where it is now, it's like almost like 4%. So it go up quite significantly, gas. And nuclear, a little bit more, around about 7%. Coal would come down to about 35-40%. So we still see some coal, but we are not going to be investing in coal that much going forward. We'll be investing in nuclear. We'll be investing in gas. We'll be also be investing in renewables.
Mteto, nuclear would be modular, small modular reactors or
big, yeah, it's big beasts? Small modular reactors, yeah.
Well, and of course, Eskom was building a small modular reactor not that long ago. Mteto Nyati, I'm so grateful you took the time to talk to me today. Thank you very, very much. Good luck and good fortune to you. And at Eskom, your consultancy, and anything else that you do, you're a precious commodity here. You said in your book you're a glutton for challenges, and we need more people like you. And thank you all for listening. I'll be back next week with another edition of Podcasts from the Edge. Keep safe and bye-bye.